Visiting these synagogues, one realizes that taken together in tandem, their names and all they embody span Jewish history, from the original fleeing of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai from a doomed city to the refusal throughout the centuries of Jews to give up hope and faith in the ultimate return, a faith sustained by the original hope and faith of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai himself. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 142, Yochanan ben Zakkai and Eliyahu Hanavi. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. If one wishes to appreciate the story of Sephardic Jewry in Jerusalem, one must go today to the Yochanan ben Zakkai Synagogue in the Jewish quarter of the Old City. To do so, one must descend, for it, like the other three synagogues that share its complex, is built inside the earth of the city itself. It is a beautiful sanctuary, but what marks it first and foremost is not its beauty, but its history. It has been the central site of Sephardic prayer in the Old City of Jerusalem for 400 years. And it is all the more striking because, unlike many other Old City synagogues, it survived the Jordanian rule over the area between 1948 and 1967. To this day, the inauguration of the Sephardic chief rabbi is marked within its walls. In the midst of visiting the sanctuary, it is easy to miss one of the most interesting aspects of it. Strikingly, apparently from the moment it was built, as long as Jews offered prayers there, the Yochanan ben Zakkai synagogue keeps on its shelf two items: a shofar to announce the Messiah when he comes, and a pitcher of oil with which to anoint him. These are small, sublime symbols of faith, preserved and perpetuated throughout the centuries. And indeed, the Sephardic synagogues in that complex teach us so much about the Jewish people and the Jewish relationship with Jerusalem. We have seen how since the arrival of Nachmanides, the central synagogue of the Jews of Jerusalem was that established by Ramban, and how the community of the city was strengthened during the period of the rabbinate of Ovadia of Bartanura by the arrival of Sephardic Jews to Jerusalem following the expulsion from Spain. Today we will discuss what followed after that for the Sephardic Jews of Jerusalem, how their synagogues developed. And this episode is profoundly indebted to Aaron Horowitz's excellent book, Jerusalem, Footsteps Through Time. In 1586, after the Ramban synagogue had already been destroyed by a mob and rebuilt by Jerusalem's Jews, the Jewish community was permanently driven from the Ramban synagogue. But the Jewish lovers of Jerusalem refused to give up. Expelled from the site where the Ramban had established Jewish prayer, they sought to serve God elsewhere in the city. The Sephardic Jews in Jerusalem found a location a bit to the south and built over the years several houses of worship that today are known as the four Sephardi synagogues of the Old City. As I mentioned, the sanctuaries are dug into the ground. This perhaps is because of the destruction of the Ramban synagogue before. Perhaps, as I believe Horowitz notes, in order to survive, one needed to ensure that one synagogue did not stick out too much as a target. And indeed, this would help ensure its endurance for the future, allowing the synagogues to survive when the Ashkenazic synagogues in the Old City would be destroyed under Jordanian rule. Without question, the most elaborate of the four Sephardic synagogues is that of Yochanan ben Zakkai. It was so named because it was built on the spot where, according to tradition or legend, the great sage had taught Torah. There is profound meaning in remembering this specific rabbi, for as we have discussed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai decided to flee the city of Jerusalem when he saw the Jewish rebel factions burning each other's food supplies, causing starvation among the Jewish rebels. In other words, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew that Jewish hatred for fellow Jews would bring ruin to ancient Jerusalem. And the rabbi, seeing a Jerusalem where Jew attacked Jew, sensed that Jerusalem would fall, not only because of the brutality of the assault of Vespasian and Titus, but also because a Jerusalem that had eschewed Jewish unity had no right to expect the miracle of the Almighty's intervention. As we have emphasized in previous episodes, Yochanan ben Zakkai understood in an elemental way that Jews would only deserve Jerusalem if they would maintain their unity. Jerusalem, as we have discussed, was chosen by David in part because it was a city shared between his tribe, Judah, and Saul's tribe, Benjamin. It was meant from the beginning to be a city of unity. And strikingly, the temple itself had been built as a joint effort by King Solomon and the sculptor Hiram or Huram, provided by the king of Tyre, a sculptor who was of Israelite descent, but who lived so far away from Jerusalem. The point, to speak in contemporary parlance, is that Jewish Jerusalem must embody Jewish bonds across time and space. It is thus striking, as we study the development and evolution of the Yochanan ben Zakkai synagogue, that we learn that a member of a very different Jewish community, descending from Jews from a very different part of the world, played a role in its ultimate creation. As Aaron Horovitz explains, and I'm citing this from Footsteps Through Time, Mordechai Schnitzer was a sculptor from Vilna who had been one of the students of the Gaon of Vilna who had made their way to the land of Israel, an aliyah that we will discuss in future episodes. He was asked by the sextons of the synagogue to design two arcs for the Torah, which he did. Today, you will see on the walls, on the right and the left of the arcs, paintings of the Kotel and the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the Cave of Machpelah, because Schnitzer had originally, utilizing an aesthetic known to Ashkenazic Jews, painted lions on either side. But these images of animals were disliked by the Sephardic chief rabbi, and so they were ultimately replaced. Nevertheless, these two arcs in the most important Sephardic synagogue in the land of Israel were designed by a Litvak, a Lithuanian Jew, and are there in the spiritual center of Sephardic Jewry to this day. Taken in tandem, the story of the arcs of the Yochanan ben Zakkai synagogue, as well as the pitcher and shofar awaiting the arrival and anointing of the Messiah, inspires the following interpretation. If Jews reflect the love of centuries for Jerusalem, and if Jews show a love for one another, then the synagogue is symbolizing, then Jews can hope for the coming of the full redemption. In a certain sense, it can be said that the shofar that is set aside in the synagogue is preserved for Elijah the prophet, who according to Malachi is the one who is designated to herald the coming of the Messiah, or as the verse pronounces, "Behold, I will send Elijah the prophet before the great and awesome day of the Lord arrives, and he shall restore the hearts of fathers to their children and children to their fathers." And interestingly, the themes of Jewish unity and redemptive aspiration found in the Yochanan ben Zakkai synagogue can also be discovered in other Sephardic synagogues that developed next door. There is the Istanbuli synagogue, created for Jews who had arrived from the Ottoman Empire. And then there is what is known as the Beit Knesset, the synagogue of Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet, named as such because it was told one day only 9 could be found for a minyan, a quorum on Yom Kippur. And suddenly a mysterious man appeared and completed the quorum, but only until the end of the sacred day. And then he was nowhere to be found. From that moment on, it was assumed that this had been Elijah the prophet, and the synagogue was named for him. And the chair in the synagogue on which the man, according to tradition, sat, was reverently preserved, a remembrance of the arrival of Elijah being linked to Elijah's concern for their Jewish community. And in the end, this synagogue came to reflect genuine Jewish unity in a resplendent fashion, because after the Six-Day War, when Sephardim returned to the Ben Zakkai sanctuary and the other synagogues in the complex, the celebrated synagogues of the Ashkenazim in the Jewish quarter had been destroyed. And so the Sephardim gave the Eliyahu HaNavi synagogue for prayer to their Ashkenazic brethren. I myself have merited to pray within the Elijah the Prophet synagogue, though I have never merited to see the appearance of the prophet himself. The tale is entrancing and redolent with significance. Communal prayer in a minyan, as Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik once argued, is meant to embody the link joining Jews across space and time, and after the Six-Day War, in a place where Elijah was believed to have come across space and time to save the minyan, room was made by the Sfaradim for a minyan for their Ashkenazic brethren. The chair on which Elijah was supposed to have sat, preserved for many years, was lost in the Jordanian conquest of 1948. But the spirit of Elijah, the spirit of helping Jews in need, that spirit of unity, this spirit pervades the room and remains. Visiting these synagogues, one realizes that taken together in tandem, their names and all they embody span Jewish history, from the original fleeing of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai from a doomed city, to the refusal throughout the centuries of Jews to give up hope and faith in the ultimate return, a faith sustained by the original hope and faith of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai himself. And of course, the synagogue name for Nachmanides, Ramban, was also brought back into being in the place that was thought to be its original site. And whether or not it is, as we discussed previously, the name testifies to the link between the yearning of Nachmanides and Jewish achievements in the present. One still descends today upon entering the Sephardic synagogues, but it is a physical descent that is spiritually uplifting. For in so doing, one communes with the lovers of Jerusalem that have come before, and one ponders with wonder what is yet to be. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.